is a podcast dedicated to bridging the gap between you, our lovely, lovely listeners, and the wacky, wonderful world of mushrooms. We have an awesome guest today, and his name is Matthew Meyer.
Matthew Meyer is a budding research mycologist and currently works as a microscopy specialist at La Jolla Institute for Immunology. In his spare time, he conducts citizen science fungal research, and he serves as the membership director for the San Diego Mycological Society. Matthew obtained his bachelor's degree at Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington, in 2017, and is currently applying to mycology PhD programs around the world. He hopes to study fungal chemical ecology with an emphasis on fungal invertebrate interactions.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, can you tell our listeners bit more about yourself, your work at university, and how you got into this subject?
Yeah, so I just kind of have always been interested in mushrooms as a kid. It was always funny to me because when I grew up here in San Diego, it's pretty dry. There aren't a lot of mushrooms around. So whenever I saw them, I thought they were really interesting and I sought them out. But I didn't really do anything about it academically until university, where I noticed there were some other like-minded people who were also interested in mushrooms. And so I started pursuing it a little bit more as an undergrad and started a mycology club. And then from there, started making some independent classes. And then once I finally had the ability to design my own senior thesis, I chose a mycology-related topic. So, and now I'm going to hopefully go to grad school for mycology.
That's awesome. And can you talk about your thesis work and you published a paper, right? And I saw the poster of it, and it looks super, super interesting. And you were telling us a little bit before the show about what you were researching, and it blew our minds. So it was really cool. Can you talk a little bit about that work?
Absolutely. So I started the undergraduate thesis as just a project for my summer abroad when I went to Costa Rica. And I was looking through the various different fungi in the area in a book, and I noticed there was psilocybe cubensis as one of the mushrooms in the local area. And it made me think, has anybody ever figured out why these mushrooms are producing psilocybin? I'd seen plenty of studies about how it's helping with all these sort of mental health things and how it affects cognition in humans, but I was curious as to what its original ecological purpose was. And then I started doing some literature research and I couldn't find anything. So I then decided I was going to go do it myself. I went and I found some P. cubensis. And then I took them back to our field station, made some extracts and started testing it on a bunch of various different organisms from bacteria and other soil microbes and then brine shrimp. And then eventually I continued that research back in the United States with some nematodes.
And what were the key findings of that research?
Yeah, so the findings were really interesting. It was that the bacteria, which I did a model gram-negative and gram-positive, E. coli and Staphylococcus aureus, and neither of them showed any inhibition. The extracts did nothing to them. But and nor did they do anything for the nematodes. But for the soil cultures, there did seem to show some inhibition of growth of various different colonies on the agar plates. So that was really interesting. As well as, though, the most impressive of all of the bioassays they did, I believe, was with the brine shrimp. Now, brine shrimp aren't anything that psilocybin-producing fungi will actually encounter in the wild, but they're used as a model organism for a lot of arthropods. And another arthropod that psilocybin fungi do interact with, or we suppose they interact with, is insects. And with the brine shrimp, the extracts killed all of them. At every concentration I used, including the lowest concentration, it killed 100% of all of the brine shrimp in 3 hours.
Wow.
My gosh.
Yeah, so that was what it... For a while, I really, really, truly believed, oh my gosh, this is clearly to defend against insects then. That's why psilocybin-producing mushrooms produced this in the first place. And then there was some ecological evidence to support that as well. And then a couple other papers seemed to suggest it. But now I'm no longer believing that quite as convincingly anymore. And that's because I've continued my research after graduation from undergrad, and I've been doing work with a psilocybin analog research chemical known as 4-ACO-DMT, and I've been using that on crickets. And the crickets have shown absolutely no mortality whatsoever with the 4-ACO-DMT. And then there was another preprint which came out from the lab of Bryn Dentiger that showed that Drosophila flies could lay their eggs inside psilocybin-producing mushrooms, and the larvae would grow up completely normally without any deformities. And that seems to suggest that it's not hurting them in any sort of way. And then there's an ongoing research with psilocybin-producing fungi that actually imitate termite eggs. And that also obviously is not killing the termites. They're being taken care of by the termites. So it seems to be showing a bit more of a complicated picture. And now my current hypothesis is that it's still evolved to interact with insects, but to mediate the interactions in some ways. And maybe some insects it's toxic, depending on the circumstances, maybe in conjunction with other compounds in their environment or something like that. And in other insects, it might actually be a mutualistic relationship where there is, let's say, it helps them spread their spores or they get taken care of in the case of the termite mimicking eggs or the termite egg mimicking fungus. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I just think it's a bit more of a complicated picture now.
It is, yeah. And this is really interesting to talk about because have you read the book Food of the Gods by Terence McKenna?
No, it's on my list, but I really want to.
Oh, it's a great, and you would love it, especially coming from this angle where I'm coming from, which is a different angle. It's a more popular theory in the magic mushroom space of how early ancestors of humans co-evolved with psilocybin. And before we, you know, there's this theory that, you know, when we were hunters and gatherers, we were following along behind animals and they were dropping dung. We were hungry, you know, we were eating mushrooms and some of those mushrooms contain psilocybin. Yeah. And then this was before we developed language and we're having these crazy experiences through neurogenesis over time of millions of years. Our brain evolved and we created language and we evolved with psilocybin to the point where now we're growing it and it's part of our a rich part of our culture. So that was the theory kind of presented by Terence McKenna. But what's really amazing is that you're coming from a different angle, which is really humbling. It's like that is a very human-centric view of the evolution of psilocybin. It's like magic mushrooms created psilocybin just for humans and like no other organism really matters. But where you're coming from is like, you know, mushrooms develop psilocybin way before early humanoids. And really the theory is that it's because of insects and really modulating their behavior. So I just want to get into it because it's really juicy and it just kind of breaks down the human-centric kind of old theory that's been going around for a while. I still really love that story by Terence, but this is just another angle that just humbles the human-centric point of view. So can you just go through kind of the history of psilocybin and serotonin and how psilocybin evolved throughout time?
Sure, absolutely. Well, first of all, I'd actually like to say that I think that there is potentially still some sort of credence to Terence McKenna's stoned ape theory, not in the sense that psilocybin evolved for us, but rather that humans evolved to be more receptive to the effects of psilocybin. I still think that that is decently possible.
Totally.
But not that psilocybin evolved for us. As you pointed out, yes, we know that at least the various different families that can produce psilocybin diversified and evolved around like almost 400 million years ago. And then it went through another diversification about 50 million years ago. And that was way before humans. Modern day humans didn't even show up until about 100,000 years ago. And so to think that it has anything to do with us is, as you pointed out, a bit human-centric.
Right. So this has obviously been, you know, modulating and having an effect on many different other organisms before humans, like for millions, hundreds of millions of years.
Yes, definitely. So I'll go through a bit of the history as you suggested. So first of all, psilocybin binds to what's known as serotonin receptors or 5-HT receptors. And serotonin is a super duper ancient molecule. The serotonin binding receptors evolved about 750 million years ago in single-celled eukaryotes. Mm-hmm. So before animals even existed at all. And it's diversified since into seven different subtypes, 1 through 7, 5-HT 1 through 7. And within animals, all animals contain 5-HT receptors except for sponges. Every other type of animal, which all have nervous systems in some way, have serotonin receptors, but they do different things in different organisms. For instance, jellyfish, it helps them with rhythmic contractions. In flatworms, it helps them with reproduction. In mollusks like snails and slugs, it helps them with feeding and learning. Crustaceans, it's aggression, and jawless fish, it's locomotion. And then in mammals like us, it helps with sleep, appetite, mood, and sensory perception regulation, which is why it can end up having the sort of tripping effects where it affects our mood and our sensory perception.
That's really interesting. I was just reading in the Handbook of Behavioral Neurobiology of Serotonin that when the animal kingdom actually began, the ability to synthesize tryptophan was lost and serotonin levels dropped dramatically at that time. And animals had to really develop and adapt many special mechanisms to secure tryptophan and notably serotonin from their diets and carefully conserve its integrity during circulation throughout the body. And that kind of goes along with Terence McKenna's, you know, stoned ape theory and what you're talking about of, you know, mushrooms didn't evolve for humans. Humans evolved to adapt to the benefits of mushrooms. And I think one of them could be, you know, since we lost the ability to synthesize tryptophan, I'm not an expert in this, but I'm just thinking that maybe going from, quote unquote, the Adam and Eve story, going out of Africa into colder climates where there's less sunlight and we're more affected by that light manipulation and have more depression and lower serotonin levels is that we're working with psilocybe and using that as kind of a happy drug and using it for our co-evolution before happy lamps and before any antidepressive drugs, keeping them in honey. And that's where, you know, the theory in Food of the Gods, the Tesli cave painting of the bee shaman, that shows like a human covered in mushrooms that has a bee head. And there's a theory that, you know, as we're leaving or going north into colder climates where there's less sunlight, less psilocybin mushrooms, that we're storing these mushrooms in honey as kind of like a serotonin store, you know, to really use that as a supplement for co-evolution. So it's really interesting, that kind of evolution through time. But I think what we haven't really talked about in this space, or it hasn't really been publicized, is how serotonin and psilocybin affects the whole rest of life, and specifically insects and other animalia.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's a fascinating idea, and I think that there's definitely some credence to it in that when you consume psilocybin, there is an upregulation of serotonin in general. Your body produces more serotonin alongside it, which is really interesting because it's already a psilocybin, which then becomes psilocin in the body, and that actually binds to serotonin receptors. Psilocin, binds to serotonin receptors, but yet at the same time, it also increases the production of more serotonin, which can sometimes lead to what's known as a serotonin syndrome if you have too much serotonin in your body. But it's a very unique and interesting idea. I had not thought about that in particular, so that's cool.
Can we talk about where these psilocybin-producing mushrooms show up? So I know, you know, they're dung loving and they are found in wood decaying niches, and maybe your thoughts on why they evolved in those particular ecosystems?
Sure. So they're, as you said, they're a lot of times found in dung and wood decay, but not exclusively. There is one sort of, there's one circumstance of it known to be in a lichen, as well as one that was found just very recently inside of a cicada parasite. And that one in particular is very unique because that's the first and only instance known of psilocybin occurring outside of basidiomycetes. It's in Massospora, which I don't remember where Massospora is anymore. Massospora used to be in Zygomycota, but it's been moved since. The fungal taxonomy is changing all of the time because of phylogenetics, but it's not a basidiomycete. So that's really interesting. It's showing up in different places, but when it is in these dung and wood decaying niches, there's a lot of competition there from other sort of organisms, both other fungi, as well as insects and other microorganisms. So there's definitely some sort of advantage to potentially producing something that can deter competitors or directly remove them, or to potentially mediate their interactions in some sort of way, have them be beneficial to you rather than be competitors. So I think that there's some credence to that. Additionally, there is one hypothesis that I have is that it could actually be for abiotic defense. In those sort of decay environments, oftentimes ammonia builds up, and ammonia is toxic to many fungi. And so because of that, ammonia could potentially have been converted into psilocybin, because ammonia does have many of the similar molecules in it to psilocybin. And so it's a possibility that they actually use this ammonia as a way to, or psilocybin as a way to detoxify ammonia. And there is an example of that walnut seeds do a similar thing with serotonin. They use serotonin to detoxify excess ammonia.
That's super interesting. We were reading this article called Horizontal Gene Cluster Transfer, Increased Hallucinogenic Mushroom Diversity. And they're talking about how some wood and dung decaying fungi share a lot of genes, and they're really similar to each other. And it was theorized that they're using horizontal gene transfer to kind of have a evolutionary advantage against insects, to deter insects that act as competition, or insects that actually eat the mycelium. Could you describe what exactly is horizontal gene transfer, and are these, you know, are some species of wood/dung decaying fungi actually stealing genes from other fungi that can produce psilocybin to be able to deter these insects? Like, are they seeing these other fungi that can produce it and saying, hey, you know, I see your advantage, can I steal some of your genes? Like, what exactly is going on?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't think that we can quite anthropomorphize them in that sort of way in terms of thinking about, like,
totally,
they actively think about it, but they might coincidentally take up the genes necessary to produce psilocybin, and then those individuals that have the ability to produce psilocybin have advantages over over the ones that didn't take it up, and then those ones proliferate more. And so via natural selection, that's the way that we can kind of anthropomorphize it in that sort of way. But to go back to your original question, horizontal gene transfer is, there are two basic ways to transfer genes to organisms, and there's horizontal and vertical. And vertical is the one that we're much more familiar with, which is having offspring, having children. You pass on your genes to a new organism through sexual reproduction or asexual reproduction, either way. But then horizontal gene transfer is interesting because it's very prevalent in a lot of prokaryotes, like bacteria, where they can take up just ambient DNA from their environment and incorporate it into their genome as they're still alive. They don't have to create a new life form to take on new genes. they just take on new genetic information while they're still alive and can incorporate it and start using it. And while some other fungi have been known to do this, non-mushroom producing fungi, so not basidiomycetes or ascomycetes, this is the very first time actually that this was described, where basidiomycete fungi have a horizontally transferred genes. So beyond the fact that it's interesting because it's psilocybin, this is just an interesting finding in the first place. So to me, this shows that there's clearly some sort of adaptive advantage to producing psilocybin if horizontal gene transfer is very rare in basidiomycetes, but all of these different fungi all have it potentially horizontally transferred. That seems to show that there's some reason why it's there. Otherwise, they wouldn't have it, or it wouldn't be found everywhere. Mm-hmm. It would have been phased out.
Is there any discussion on whether or not one species developed psilocybin independently?
Yeah, so there was a more recent preprint that actually came out in 2018, I believe, that was by Bryn Dentinger's lab, and his work showed that there were some independent derivations of the psilocybin gene cluster, or rather it was a different gene cluster altogether, but ultimately ended up still producing psilocybin. So the fact that it's been produced, it's been convergently produced independently several times, and also is horizontally transferred, I mean, to me, yeah, again, just really shows that there's something going on here. It's still a bit of a mystery as to what, but it seems compelling to me.
Yeah, likewise.
I'm very curious on, you know, I have to do a lot more research into this. It just kind of sparked my interest of the correlation between this and entomopathogenic fungi, because it seems like horizontal gene transfer is really common in Ascomycota, and, you know, there's so many species of insects, and it seems like entomopathogenic fungi are really like using kind of the same, are secreting these compounds to interact with insects and kind of control them in to do their bidding, which it seems like psilocybin is kind of doing the same thing of secreting compounds to really control an insect's bidding. And Massospora, which grows on the cicada, you know, which was very famous just recently, of it's a horrific story about kind of quote unquote cordyceps or entomopathogenic fungi attacking cicada and eating their butt off. And it was also found to have this, it was found to have psilocybin, and then I'm drawing a blank on the name, like an adrenaline producing compound.
Oh, cathinone.
Yeah, cathinone, exactly. And
it's an amphetamine.
Amphetamine, thanks. I slipped on the name of what an amphetamine is, but
no worries.
Totally. And and it's controlling the insect to do its bidding, and using the psilocybin pathway with, you know, its entomopathogenic actions. And so that was really curious. And we're just doing research on Ophiocordyceps unilateralis, which is the infamous mushroom that grows out of a carpenter ant that you see on planet Earth and things like that. Mm-hmm. And they were describing the compounds that it shoots into this ant. And one of the compounds was ergot, and various alkaloids, and ergot leads to a serotonergic overstimulation of the nervous system. So I have to go more research into it, but it seems like there's a lot of parallels between what cordyceps are doing and what entomopathogenic fungi are doing and what psilocybin mushrooms are doing to control insects. And I'm just curious, do you think that the horizontal gene transfer helped the development of the diversity of entomopathogenic fungi to control insect population?
You know, it's a very distinct possibility. I believe that there was another paper that came out just earlier this, oh no, not this year, 2019. It's 2020 now. But that actually showed more instances of horizontal gene transfer in higher fungi after the psilocybin gene cluster. And it's very possible that we might find that as well as in more entomopathogenic fungi. I believe that it was actually the same one that's in Massospora as is in a lot of these basidiomycetes, which is really interesting because it's very far away. Genetically speaking, it's incredibly far away. So it's possible we'll also find more entomopathogenic fungi that also produce psilocybin. And like you pointed out, that's really interesting that they produce ergot, because ergot is actually, or ergotamine, yeah, is a, it's a lysergamide. So it's actually a, basically a precursor to LSD. And those share similar structures to psilocybin in that they both have a serotonin action inside, or tryptamine action.
I just saw like a crazy similarity, and it just like really sparked my interest. Actually, right before we were on air, I was like flipping through some books, trying to, you know, dive into it. Yeah, now I'm geeking out. Now I really want to dive down that area and really find out what's going on with cordyceps.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Send me some of that stuff. I would love to hear about it too.
Totally. Yeah.
For sure. Can we get a little deeper into the whole genome of psilocybin? You sent one paper that was pretty cool, just talking about the beta carbolines present and where they show up in different species and like all the different orchestras that you need in order for the fungus to actually be considered psychoactive.
Yeah, absolutely. So that paper just came out. It's very new. And what's really interesting about it is that it's showing for the first time that psilocybin producing fungi also actually produce beta carbolines, which are also known as are monooxidase inhibitors, MAOIs. And those are used in a lot of psychedelic brews such as ayahuasca to increase the potency of other psychedelic tryptamines. And so psilocybin producing fungi seem to be able to do it natively, which was not known before at all. But the caveat here is that it's actually these beta carbolines or MAOIs are found more often or in much, much higher concentration, 100-fold in the mycelium than in the fruiting bodies. So that's really interesting and unique. As you all point out a lot, oftentimes a lot of these sort of unique compounds that are interesting are found in the fruiting bodies, not in the mycelium. But in this case, it does seem to be the opposite. The beta carbolines are found in much higher concentrations in the mycelium, and also found in the sclerotia of P. mexicana at about like 7 times the rate of the mushroom. So to me, this suggests that if it's for sort of a defensive purpose or to mediate interactions with organisms, there's different organisms that it's interacting with like underground versus in the air. And that potentially this might be to inhibit inhibit other fungi or bacteria in the soil or subterranean targets like nematodes or annelids like earthworms.
This paper that he's talking about is called the simultaneous production of psilocybin and a cocktail of B carboline monoamine oxidase inhibitors in magic mushrooms. Awesome paper. Highly recommend it. I was geeking out about this paper, so thanks for sharing that. Thought it was really awesome. And it's really curious. I was in Ecuador about 4 years ago studying leafcutter ants, and they're notorious for farming fungi and farming mycelium in their nests. And they go up in trees and they take a little bit of the leaf and they bite them up into this mush, this leaf mush. And the queen actually steals a piece of mushroom tissue from a local mushroom. And I think they work with like 3 different species, but mostly 1 species that I forget the name. And they grow up mycelium in this like leaf mush. And they have antifungal and antimicrobial compounds and antifungal compounds in their saliva that works on all different types of fungi except for this specific one. And they actually eat the hyphal tip. And this is, you know, the beta carbolines in this study showed that, you know, there's a ton of beta carbolines in the hyphal tip. And that's what these insects are eating. And the hyphal tip, for our listeners who don't know, is kind of the tip of the root, so to speak, if you want to...
It's like the edge of the mycelium, you know, where it's...
Yeah, the very tip where it is growing out. So that's really interesting of, you know, there's a lot less psilocybin in the mycelium than the fruit body, but there's way more of these beta carbolines, which are MAOIs. What's going on? Like, I'm so curious, like, what effect does it have on insects?
And why it's concentrated in the Spitzenkörper.
Exactly. I also thought that paper was interesting. It mentioned a relationship between beta carbolines in Psilocybe mexicana and Ophiocordyceps sinescens. Can you talk a little bit more about that? And what does this suggest about Ophiocordyceps sinescens?
Yeah, I mean, it suggests that potentially, like you said, it might be to affect insects, because we know that Ophiocordyceps sinescens is an entomopathogen. So it might be potentially that the P. mexicana is also producing it for the same reason, to interact with subterranean insects, because it's in the mycelium underground, as well as in the sclerotia. So I think there's a good chance that we might find some ecological overlap or ecological functionality overlap between those two, even if P. mexicana is not obviously an entomopathogen that we know of, at least. I don't believe it's ever been discovered parasitizing any insects.
Yeah, it was interesting. We pulled up cortisinins C and D, which are the two molecules that this paper mentioned being really similar to the B carbolines. And sure enough, on MolView, I don't know if you use this website, it's pretty great, but you can just type in any kind of compound and it will give you a visual of it. And there's like a 3D model and then just your basic two-dimensional one. And they were pretty much identical. Like, I could see them docking onto the same transmitters. So it was compelling for sure. It goes back to your entomopathogenic consideration.
Which is why I'm geeking out about this.
I just
kind of unearthed this gold, like,
this afternoon.
This afternoon. So I wish I had more time to really just like go into it, but we're going into it now. And another thing that I thought was really interesting is that in the indigenous peoples in central Mexico used certain types of cordyceps. So two quote unquote cordyceps. So there's Cordyceps capitata, and then the old name, which is Cordyceps ophioglossoides, or Tolipoclidium ophioglossoides, which it was now changed to. They both grow on a deer truffle in the Elaphomycete family. But they used to, early ancestors, they used to grow on insects, and they kind of jumped kingdoms to grow on this Elaphomycete truffle. Whoa. So in central Mexico, a lot of these quote-unquote shamans or curanderos will hold these holy rituals or veladas, and they'll combine the Tolipoclidium ophioglossoides and Cordyceps capitata with Psilocybe molecula. I'm totally butchering that name. Molecula.
And, oh, no worries. But Latin is hard.
Yeah, so they're combining both of those cordyceps, one tolipocladium, that are growing on the Elaphomycete truffle. They're combining that with another Elaphomycete and then a hypogynum, and making this whole mix. And they pulverize and they mix that and they use it in ceremony. So I thought that was really interesting that, you know, they knew that there was MAOI compounds in the truffle. So, you know, I don't know if there are in the deer truffle Elaphomycete. I'm guessing that's what my hypothesis is why they were using it. I could also see some lung capacity increase, oxygenation in the body, kind of pushing the psilocybin into your bloodstream to help it. But I thought that was an interesting historical use of kind of combining the truffle with psilocybin as kind of this quote-unquote ayahuasca brew.
Man, that's amazing. I actually had no idea about this. It just goes to show you again and again that the more that we figure out is that native peoples have figured this out thousands of years ago.
And before we started talking a couple weeks ago, I thought the reason mushrooms were more potent than pure psilocybin was because of some sort of synergistic effects between the various tryptamines. But it kind of is suggesting that the mushrooms actually produce MAOI inhibitors that make this extremely potent and serve as more of an ayahuasca cocktail. when you metabolize it.
Yeah, I know. That isn't that amazing? It was there the whole time, and we just didn't even know.
Totally. That was a great new fun fact for me.
In that paper, it was also talking about baocystin, norbaocystin, and let me see if I can just pull it up really quick. Norcilicin, which I've never even heard of norcilicin. It's really interesting. Do you recall what actions that baocystin, norbaocystin, and norcilicin had? And do you know of any research on insects on those other compounds?
Yeah, unfortunately, there is no research on any of them on insects, nor on humans, really. There is some anecdotal evidence about each one of those compounds, but it's really anecdotal, like a couple people here and there, because before the opportunity to potentially do any real research on isolating those individual compounds and trying them, there was a prohibition. So it became much more difficult to do any sort of research on that. Unfortunately, there really isn't any research at all on psilocybin or its analogs, baocystin, norbaocystin, those other ones, on insects or really other animals. I think other than my study and then Bryn Dentinger's study, I believe that we're the only two that have done any sort of research with this so far. I hope that changes very soon, but at the moment, there's very little ecological research associated with this.
I think we're really on the curtails of the cannabis industry, and this is really exciting. We're doing so much research in the cannabis space on all these different compounds and the terpenes and, you know, CBD, CBN, and all the entourage effect that they're talking about. I think the same thing with the psilocybin industry. And, you know, as it progresses in our country with the giving out license for people to use this as end of life care and for depression, anxiety, PTSD, a lot of these therapeutic actions, I think we're going to have an understanding on different strains and different compositions of the beta carbolines and, you know, norbaocystin percentage with the psilocybin versus the psilocin percentage versus the norcilicin percentage. And I think it's going to be a really awesome place to be. And I know one story with Maria Sabina, how I forget his name, who first synthesized psilocybin. Do you know his name?
It's also somewhere.
Was it Albert Hoffman?
I think it was Albert Hoffman.
Might have been Albert Hoffman. Maybe I'm sure there's listeners listening to this like, oh my God.
Y'all don't know that?
Actually, I'm going to just Google it right now. But basically, he gave it to Maria Sabina, and Maria Sabina said that it took the magic out of it. And she could no longer hear the voices of the spirits and the Icaros or the songs of the spirits, the mushroom spirit. So I thought that was really interesting. We're hearing it from a curandera that's working with this psilocybin mushroom and kind of going back to what you're saying of this wisdom has been entrenched in indigenous peoples for so long, and we're just kind of having our own language to it. It's a different way to describe what's going on. And I think that, you know, the trials first start with single compounds to really make them very controlled, but I think we're gonna curtail the cannabis industry with the entourage effect and really understanding what all these different compounds are doing and working together and why that we're seeing beta carbolines in the mycelium on the hyphal tips and what those actions are and what is norbaocystin doing. And that's really juicy. I'm really excited for that research.
Oh, me too. I mean, no, I'm thrilled. And I've been actively looking. So right now I'm currently doing research with this this research chemical. It's known as 4-ACO-DMT. And it's like psilocybin, it's a prodrug for psilocin. Meaning when it's metabolized, it becomes psilocin. And so I'm using that with insects right now. I'm hoping to move on to Drosophila soon too, actually, from crickets. But it's isolated, you know, like you said, it's just essentially the equivalent of psilocybin. And so I would love to have, until, you know, whatever, prohibition ends, I would love to have the actual, like, analogs of, as well of, Bay Assistant and Nor Bay Assistant at the very least to try to see what that entourage effect is like and see how that compares to isolates when testing it on various organisms. But unfortunately, it doesn't seem like they really exist at the moment. So if any of your audience members know of any and I'm wrong, please let me know.
Can you talk about the compound, the analog that you were just talking about?
Sure. Yeah. So it's called 4-ACO-DMT, or it's also known as psilocetin or 4-O-acetylsilocin. It goes by many different names. But essentially, it's psilocybin has a phosphate group on it. And when it's metabolized, it becomes psilocin. And the phosphate group breaks off and becomes a hydroxyl group. And in 4-ACO-DMT, it's the exact same molecule as psilocybin, except for the phosphate group is replaced by an acetyl group. And again, when metabolized in the body, the acetyl group breaks off and becomes that same hydroxyl.
Psilocin.
So
yeah,
it becomes
exactly.
Psilocin.
Cool. And
but
is
it's
that
a,
legal?
But it's a legal.
Can anyone buy that?
It is a legal analog for research purposes only.
Got it. So did you have to get a permit to work with that?
I had to confirm and submit a research proposal to the vendor to prove that I was actually doing research with it.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That's great that you at least have that and it's chemically identical. So that's progress, I think.
Yeah, it's definitely better than having to do something illegally or I could have potentially, let's say, gone to Jamaica where there's no restrictions there, but that would have been a much bigger ordeal.
It's hard. I was in Jamaica a couple of years ago doing some work. We're trying to start up a mushroom farm and amazing. I love Jamaica, love the food, the culture, met some really amazing people there. And it's crazy because, you know, psilocybin is completely legal. There's no laws talking about it. And it's really funny. I was talking to a lot of people about it and they were like, yeah, everyone thinks mushrooms are weird or like, except for a few Rastas that kind of get it. But most people are really mycophobic. And, you know, I heard a lot of people say that mushrooms, you know, people in Jamaica call all mushrooms the same thing. And it's John Crow boogers. And they're like, why would we make it illegal? Like, why would anyone eat those? You know, and I thought it was like a really funny way to put it. It's like, we don't have to make it illegal because why would you even eat those? Yeah. And
That's hilarious.
It's hard.
I didn't know that.
It's an island, you know, and we were struggling getting materials and supplies and like even just there. We're really privileged here in the United States and, you know, in a lot of most areas in the United States, you have easy access to stores. And, you know, we have Amazon that you can just ship anything to your door, you know, with Prime shipping. And it's like, that is not a thing in Jamaica. Like, if you wanted to go to the store, like, you don't have a lot of things. You got to go 40 minutes down this, like, super rocky, holy road to pick up something. And, yeah, so I think it would be, you know, awesome. It would just take a lot slower to really do that research and get all the materials. But yeah, another option would be Brazil, which is another option to do that research. And they also do not have any laws. And I think maybe Brazil would be easier to do that research since it's you have access to, you know, a bunch of different countries around it. And I think shipping would be a lot easier. But who knows? Yeah, I love Jamaica. I wish it was easier. And I would be down there right now doing that.
No, I know that though, at least in the University of West Indies is actually opening an entire center specifically devoted to psilocybin research, actually.
Yeah, there's a few people with a lot of money doing that research, and I'm sure they're running into a lot of problems with importation and really getting the supplies they need, but I'm sure they're doing it. And I'm really excited to see their progress. And I think they're killing it. I think they're doing an amazing job so far. I know there's been a psilocybin retreat center there for a while. We had Eric Osborne on our show. He was one of our first guests and he was talking about his retreat center he's had for 10 plus years, maybe.
Yes.
So it seems amazing. I would love to go to his retreat center and see what research they're doing down there. I think that's really awesome.
Yeah, that's great. I'm glad that there is a space in the world that this can happen.
Yeah, agreed. So I wanted to revisit the paper you sent me, Convergent Evolution of Psilocybin Biosynthesis and Psychedelic Mushrooms. I thought it was interesting that they were talking about these psilocybin gene clusters showing up in other species that aren't psychoactive. So for example, my favorite example was that there was a near perfect match for a psilocybin gene cluster in Agaricus bisporus, which for everyone out there, that's like the button mushroom. That's the portobellos you buy in the store. And what do you think is missing from a fungus like this that renders it non-psychoactive?
Well, okay, I have to admit, I'm not a biochemical pathway expert. So I don't know specifically, at least in Agaricus bisporus, what is missing. But my guess is that there was an ancestor of Agaricus bisporus that was able to produce psilocybin, and it lost the capacity because it was no longer advantageous for some reason. But you know, it can be something very simple. If something, one thing along the pathway is broken, even if it has something before and after to potentially take it up, but there's no, there's a step in the middle it's missing, then you just don't get it. So it can be anything, really. If anybody else out there does know, please let me know. I'm curious as well.
Yeah, it is interesting for sure. I guess it could be considered like junk DNA at this point.
I think that junk DNA is a bit of a misnomer in my opinion, because a lot of times what's considered junk is actually doing something. It's not coding for a protein, let's say, but it is coding for it does other sort of regulatory mechanisms, or it's co-opted for something else, or it's something that's basically dormant that could potentially come back up later. Potentially, you know, in the future, a descendant of Agaricus bisporus, it could be advantageous for it to produce psilocybin again, and it might have like one mutant that has the ability to then start to produce it again might have some sort of advantage over its competitors.
I'm waiting for the day that all the button mushroom farms just have a mutant and a strain gets out by someone, not anyone on that's talking right now. We would never release a strain
when
like
you
that.
When you cook it, it starts turning blue.
Yeah, and then everyone. There's just like a mass, you know, button mushroom trip, and people putting it on their pizza and in salad bars and everywhere across the world, just like have this simultaneous.
And then we go from Homo sapien to the next.
Exactly. Yeah.
Homo cubensis.
Yes.
Fuck yeah. That's where I want to be.
I love that. That's
life
great.
Goals. 2020. Let's do it.
I have a taxonomy question. So,
sure.
Since there are species that have psilocybe in their Latin binomial, but they don't contain any psilocybin, what does this mean? What does that christening actually mean for a species?
Yeah, okay. So actually the genus psilocybe actually was first described before psilocybin was even described. So the compound psilocybin was named after the genus. And since then, the vast majority of the non-psychoactive psilocybe species have actually been moved out into other genera. Again, fungal taxonomy is crazy. It's changing all of the time because of phylogenetics. And so I'm going to wait for the day for things to settle down, because right now it's just like everything's moving around constantly. To the best of my knowledge, there's only one species of psilocybe, only one current species of psilocybe that is actually non-psychoactive now. And I'll have to pull that up. I actually recently found out what this one was. So the one species of psilocybe that is not psychoactive is psilocybe atrobrunea. And that's the only one that I think is currently still in the genus psilocybe and is non-psychoactive.
Cool. Now we know.
Mm-hmm.
Just hanging out there, like, trying to fit in.
Joke's on you, yeah.
My guess is that it probably, again, they all, the whole genus psilocybe shared a common ancestor that could produce psilocybin, and then for some reason, psilocybe atrobrunea, for some reason, lost it, the ability to produce it.
I feel so bad. That sucks.
Me,
it's picked on by all the other philosophy.
Okay, so I want to get into more of your hypotheses and like the evolutionary advantages of psilocybin. I know you briefly touched on abiotic defense against ammonia and, of course, mitigating the relationship between insects. But you also mentioned before the show and somewhere where I read about ultraviolet defense, and that was intriguing if you wanted to mention that.
Sure, yeah. So this one is another hypothesis, just that there are other serotonin analogs or tryptamines that do provide ultraviolet defense. The one that we probably all know the best is melatonin. Melatonin is a tryptamine like psilocybin, and it does protect against UV, not just in humans, but in tons of other animals and in plants. So that was really interesting. It also happens that relating to ultraviolet defense, a lot of serotonin analogs also can suppress tumor growth, and it can inhibit the proliferation of tumor cells, cancerous cells, but not normal cells. So that could also be related to ultraviolet damage and helping prevent the spread of that, because fungi are able to get essentially cancerous growths. It's not the same sort of kind of cancer that we would get, but they can have cells that rapidly proliferate incorrectly.
And that's melatonin and not melanin, right?
Yes, melatonin and melanin. I misspoke. Thank you. There is melatonin and melanin, and they both actually can provide UV protection. Melatonin does it in plants. My apologies. And melanin does it in animals.
Huh. Whoa. That's awesome. Do you know if we can uptake melatonin from plants?
I don't think we incorporate it into our skin pigmentation, if that's the question, but I mean, I do believe we can take up melatonin. Which is why, you know, there are melatonin supplements and everything.
Right, exactly.
So you also sent a paper that I've read before about the blue bruising, and I guess people finally found out, like, what was resulting in this color in psychoactive mushrooms. And it had implications of defense. And, I just wanted you to talk about this with your perspective and how you're applying this information into your own research.
Yeah, of course. That one I thought was super fascinating. So the bluing reaction has been unknown for so, so long. It's kind of funny how long we haven't known what causes the blue compound or what compound is blue when you damage a psilocybin-producing mushroom. And it turns out it's not just one compound. There are several different compounds that make it look blue. But what happens is that the psilocin, when damaged, interacts with some enzymes that are extracellular. So when the cellular membranes are broken with damage, the enzymes cause the psilocin molecules to dimerize. So meaning two psilocin molecules come together and essentially create something that looks very similar to indigo dye. It looks to the molecule of indigo dye. And then that dimer links up to other dimers, and it creates what's known as a polymer. It can go on, it can expand for a long, long time. It creates a giant polymer. And that's what the blue reaction is in these psilocybin mushrooms. But what's interesting about this for a defense purpose is that the compounds, these polymers, actually resemble the structures of flavonoids and polyphenolic tannins that are, and in plants, those kind of molecules can produce what's known as a reactive oxygen species and create intestinal lesions in insect guts. It's kind of crazy. So obviously this hasn't been tested, but it's very possible that this compound or these polymers in the psilocybin producing fungi also can cause these intestinal lesions in insect guts as well. And it would be an on-command defense response, which is incredibly cool, because they don't need to have it all the time. They can just have it once they're damaged because an insect is eating them.
That worries me a little bit. I hope there's going to be research on human guts as well, because, if it's... causing lesions and
why are you eating magic mushrooms, Alex?
I think there's going to be a rise of I'm just curious what effect that has on mammals. I'm curious.
Well, I know that already that, I mean, flavonoids actually at least are used medicinally by humans. So it's similar to like cordyceps, you know, it can be quite bad for insects, but for humans, it's good. So it's one of those sort of situations. It creates reactive oxygen species that can damage insects' guts because they work in a different way than mammal guts. And they're much, much smaller as well, obviously, than our guts. So I wouldn't worry so much about that. That particular aspect.
Interesting.
I'm sure there will be research.
It makes the mushrooms actually less potent because the psilocin is breaking down, and that is the active, you know, psychotropic compound. It turns into another compound. So I'm curious if that has any interaction for mammals. And I think, you know, that's a really curious thing, you know, as we're seeing with the beta carbolines and, you know, and a lot of these compounds are theorized to be, you know, specifically targeted towards insects, and we kind of evolved, or so it's theorized to kind of adapt with these mushrooms and use them in our own bodies with our evolution. So I'm curious, like, if that blue bruising compound does anything, or it has any synergistic properties with any other compound.
That would be really cool. I would love to see some research done on isolating just these blue polymers and seeing if the blue polymers have any sort of psychoactivity of their own. My guess is that they won't, but I mean, never say never, you know, we'll find out. I hope that somebody does that research.
Are you planning to work with, what is that fish that a lot of researchers use to test compounds? There's a specific fish that I've heard a lot of people use.
Zebrafish?
Yeah. Do you plan to use that in your research?
I wasn't planning on it.
Rats? You know, that rats would be one.
And rats have been done as well. But, you know, again, it would be interesting to see what the effects would be on them. But I really don't believe that psilocybin evolved, at least initially. Maybe it's taken on a new role since to interact with mammals, because actually, again, the clades that diversified, that contained psilocybin, they diversified in the Carboniferous period. And in the Carboniferous period, mammals didn't even exist yet. Mammals weren't even around. So my guess is that they probably didn't have anything to do with mammals. Maybe the zebrafish might be interesting because, again, like you said, it's a model organism in a lot of ways. But to the best of my knowledge, I don't know of any aquatic species that produce psilocybin. So it would be kind of like, it would be for the purposes of being a model organism, like what I did with the brine shrimp, which obviously they won't be interacting with psilocybin mushrooms in the real world.
Totally. Yeah. I'm excited for just, you know, we need infinite research on this topic.
Oh, yeah.
Can we dive into the paper interactions between Psilocybe fasciata and its companion fungus? I'm going to butcher this, but Acrimonium strictum, and what the findings suggest about psilocybin's influence on other fungi?
Yeah, we talked all about fungi and insects, but turns out psilocybin can have some interference with fungi and fungi.
Yeah, so that's absolutely interesting. So yeah, I mean, it is really interesting. I think that this one pairs really nicely with the other paper that's also starts with interactions between. So there's the interactions between psilocybin fasciata and its companion fungus, Acrimonium strictum. And in that one, it shows that basically A. strictum is like intertwined with the mycelium of P. fasciata. And while P. fasciata has this, hypothesized to have this ability to be defensive against other organisms because of its psychoactivity, A. strictum doesn't, but it doesn't harm A. strictum in any way. So it's possible that there is either the relationship is either commensalistic, which means that A. fasciata is benefiting and A. strictum is benefiting and P. fasciata just doesn't really care one way or another, or it's mutualistic in some way that A. strictum is also providing some sort of reciprocation for the defensiveness that PFASciata can provide. And what that is, this paper doesn't actually, it doesn't know at this point in time, but I would love to see more research on fungus-fungus interactions regarding psilocybin, because then the other paper, which is the interactions between psilocybe semilenceta and fungi of its habitat, that one seems to show that when co-incubated in a dual culture, many of the fungi found in the rhizosphere that are naturally found in the rhizosphere around psilocybe semilenceta are inhibited when grown together. And there is only a couple that inhibited P. semilenceta, but P. semilenceta seemed to inhibit most of the other ones.
Yeah, I like the paper before talking about Psilocybe fasciata and A. strictum, because they were analyzing the enzymes, and I'm like an enzyme geek. I think that's enzymes in fungi are, I think, the future for many different industries. And they were kind of measuring the chitinase and the beta-1,3 glucanase, which are enzymes, which obviously mushrooms are made out of chitin and beta-1,3 glucans, and you know these enzymes would break them down. So they're trying to see is, you know, this A. strictum breaking down this psilocybe fasciata, and is it a parasite? They didn't find those enzymes, or very, very, very low. That's just like meaningless. And they did find that they were producing the same enzymes to break down things in their environment. So they were kind of working in tandem, what it seemed like, to kind of work as allies to both excrete the same compounds to break everything around them down. And that paper proposed that psilocybe fasciata was actually protecting the Acrimonium strictum with its psychoactive compounds. So I thought that was pretty cool. And I think there was another paper that was talking about psilocybin increasing one insect's hunger and eating habits. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, so that was the preprint by Bryn Dentinger. And that one is actually, it's just hypothesized that it increases the appetite. It wasn't actually experimentally demonstrated. But I think it's a reasonable hypothesis because psilocybin, again, or psilocin, binds to 5-HT receptors, 5-HT2A in particular. And it's actually shown that serotonin, an increase in serotonin, which also binds to those receptors, actually increases appetite. So if this is also binding to the receptors, it's also acting as an agonist as opposed to an antagonist, there's a good chance that it could increase appetite. But it hasn't been experimentally demonstrated yet.
Interesting. I'm curious if it, because I know a lot of plants will use insects as kind of its their bouncer, so to speak, or their security. And if another insect is coming in, they'll actually release pheromones to bring in the parasite of that other insect. So I'm curious if fungi are doing the same thing and just kind of using insects, kind of like entomopathogenic fungi, to do their bidding, and kind of like modulating their whole nervous systems and just kind of like, hey, this one insect is biting me, why don't you attack this other insect and I'll make you more hungry, and or another fungus, like, why don't I'm going to increase your hunger, and why don't you eat that other mycelium, because I'm too busy using my enzymes to break down this woody material, and I don't want to use my enzymes to fight off this other fungi, why don't you just eat it and I'll give you psilocybin. Like, I don't know if that's right, going no, on, but I think that would be really cool.
No, it's all up in the air at this point. I mean, I think that that's a pretty good hypothesis. And that's kind of what I'm hypothesizing at this point, is that it is like psilocybin did evolve to mediate interactions with insects in some sort of way, control the insects to do something. And maybe it's different in different insects, or maybe it's universal. My guess is it's probably not universal. But like, for instance, again, I was talking about there's the termite eggs, or like, there's a specific type of fungus that produces sclerotia that look like termite eggs. And the termite eggs are taken, or these fungi are taken care of as if they were actually termite eggs in the nest. They're cleaned and they're fed and all of these things. And I'm wondering if part of why they're willing to take care of these eggs is because they produce psilocybin, and that somehow makes them less, you know, they scrutinize less the distinction between them and their actual eggs.
I want to get into nematodes because I read this fact that you provided in our document that blew my mind. And that was that nematodes consume half of the global fungal biomass in soil. So I guess another possibility is that psilocybin may be reducing nematodes' reproductive fitness. But I also saw on your poster that your results came back as low toxicity when you introduced your makeshift psilocybin to the nematodes.
Absolutely. So I think that they have that psilocybin producing fungi have a big incentive to defend against nematodes. As you said, it's found that nematodes consume half of the subterranean fungal biomass.
That's crazy.
Globally. Yeah. They're a huge predator. So
that's where all the carbon sink is. Like, we should just attack nematodes. I don't know what benefits that nematodes have. I'm not a nematode expert, but they seem like they're fucking fungi up.
No, but they definitely have benefits. So that we should not remove them from the ecosystem. But
Don't listen to me.
When I did my experiments, which was I inoculated an agar plate with E. coli, which is their natural food source for Caenorhabditis elegans, which is a very common model organism. I didn't notice any increase in mortality whatsoever, really. And I have since learned, unfortunately, that it might have been a flaw in my experimental design. So I would love to repeat the experiment. I just put the straight extract onto the plate in hopes that they would just uptake it sort of transdermally or while they were eating the E. coli. But I have since found out that actually, these nematodes, they take in the E. coli alongside with the other aqueous solution, and then they spit out the rest of the aqueous solution and just retain the E. coli. So it's possible that they were actually getting very little of the psilocybin because they were spitting it back out. I mean, I'm sure they were getting some, but they were probably getting very little. So wow. A way to potentially avoid that in the future, if I were to repeat this, would be to create what are known as liposomes, which would contain right. the psilocybin. So
cool.
That way,
hell yeah. Yeah. I'm super about that. That's great.
Yeah. And then that way, because there are methods that do show that you can create liposomes and put your drug products in them. And that's actually a much more effective way to do these sort of drug dosing experiments with nematodes is by putting your drug product in liposomes. And so if I were to repeat it, I would definitely do that.
Wow. I'm excited to watch for that research.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I hope it can happen someday.
For sure.
That one's a little bit harder to do at home. So I'll probably need a lab to do that one because all I have access to at home is just, well, you know, crickets are easy. I can buy those at a pet store. And such. So I'm limited by my means as a citizen scientist right now, which is exactly why I've been applying for grad schools.
Yeah. So do you want to talk about any of the neurological effects that psilocybin could potentially have on these insects? I know there's very little literature, but there was that famous spider web weaving one. Although spiders aren't technically insects, I still think it has implications that maybe they are experiencing something neurologically upsetting or stimulating in a good way.
That actually blew my mind. I didn't know that spiders weren't insects. That was pretty crazy to me.
Yes, spiders are arachnids. So like scorpions. Scorpions are also arachnids.
Right.
So
yeah.
Scorpions
did
are not
know that
either. Yeah, it's all crazy. Also, millipedes and centipedes, also not insects. I know, yeah, they're all arthropods together alongside with crustaceans, but not insects. but arachnids and insects are very closely related. So I think there's a good chance that something that happens to an arachnid might tell you something about what will happen in an insect, even if it's not exactly one-to-one. And anyways, yeah, this study, I think, is the other than my research, is the, and that other one paper I described earlier, is the only thing that has actually been done with psilocybin directly applied to an arthropod. And this was done back in the 60s, too. So it found that with increasing doses of psilocybin, it decreased the web thread length and web building frequency of the spiders. And once you finally reached a dose of 6 grams per kilogram, as in 6 grams of psilocybin per kilogram of the spider's body weight, so obviously that translates far down because there is no spider that weighs a kilogram. But at that dose, it completely stopped web building altogether. Just they didn't produce webs at all.
That's interesting that there was that threshold.
That's so low. I thought it was really funny too that it might have been this paper or another paper on that was describing the same thing about how they were correlating the dose of psilocybin to spiders with also how much spiders weigh. So I don't know how they did this, but I think they fattened up some spiders. they basically found that a certain weight of the spider, they would have, it was kind of correlated this, they would do the same kind of web structure as dosing them with either psilocybin or I think peyote, maybe?
Mescaline?
They basically shortened their thread length, but the thread was actually thicker. So they were like, yeah, because it's a fat spider, it would need a thicker thread to sit on. But it was just interesting that it did the same thing if it was dosed with psilocybin. Maybe it's gravity was
synesthesia.
Yeah, no, maybe gravity was just was weird.
It might be messing with its own like sense of its own weight.
Yeah, and then at 6 grams per kilogram, it's like I'm one with nature. I don't exist. Complete ego death. Why would I make a web? I am the web. That's cool.
That is cool. Yeah. But I mean, we do know that, for instance, like serotonin, even though we don't know how psilocybin will affect these functions specifically, we do know that serotonin impacts a variety of functions in insects, such as sleep, memory, visual information processing, swarming behavior in social insects, and aggression, heart rate, you know, tons of things, reproduction, appetite, and digestion. Like, you know, it affects a whole gamut of things. So psilocybin could easily interact with all of those as well.
So can you talk about some of the broader impacts of psilocybin in the ecology?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, obviously, first of all, it just exists out there. And so it's doing stuff right now. And so having a better picture of how our ecosystem works and how these fit into the ecosystem is incredibly important in terms of like conservation work and such. But if we're talking about human-related impacts, you know, insects are a huge source of human suffering. For instance, mosquito-borne illness causes over, like, I think about 1 million deaths per year, and insects consume, up to 20% of grain crops worldwide. So if we could find, if we do find that psilocybin interferes with serotonin, that could be potentially really, really beneficial because we know that interference with serotonin signaling can decrease blood probing in mosquitoes and feeding behavior in many other insects. So if psilocybin or maybe like a human-created analog that's more specific for these purposes were developed, it could create a new sort of insect deterrent. And we know at least psilocybin has a very high human safety profile, so it could potentially even replace some other forms of pesticides that are currently wreaking havoc in the environment otherwise and on humans. That's just one example, but there's...
Can I go off that for a second? There's a crazy article that I read, I think like a year ago, about some researchers basically bioengineering a Metarhizium pingxingxi. I'm probably butchering that, but Metarhizium is basically like a really, really famous fungi for natural insect control or bio control. And they bioengineered this fungi to release toxins that are actually poisons, venom that are in scorpions and spiders. And it actually like it, the fungi, you know, it kind of acts like the cicada where it, you know, mates with other mosquitoes and it gets transferred that way. And then the fungi secretes these poisons or venoms, which drills into the chitin of the insect and just like kills it from the inside out with these venoms. And it's like way faster of a death. And it's like a delayed effect, so it only happens post mating. It's really crazy. Like
wow.
Yeah, the scientists that were coming up with this are like pretty dark. I have a lot of respect for that. I was like, that's really fucked up in a lot of ways. And it was really controversial because they were wanting to do test plots in some African countries, and a lot of people were like really pissed about it. And they're like, why don't use Africa as your sandbox for, you know, right. If this goes wrong, you know, you're going to go about your daily life like nothing happened. And you're like, oh, next, what's the next scientific experiment? Mm-hmm. You know, and it sucks. I think it's like, it can be really cool. And I'm really jazzed about the idea of entomopathogenic fungi, especially with psilocybin. I mean, that's super cool in using that as a biopesticide, but there could be some repercussions that we just don't know about.
Absolutely. You always run the risk of that. And it is unfortunate because, yeah, we do end up using a lot. There is a very, prominent history of Western countries using non-Western countries as testing grounds for potentially controversial and dangerous things. It's pretty dubious.
Can you talk a little bit about fungal pathogens, specifically Banana fusarium?
Yeah, so that was one thing that I wanted to, another thing that I wanted to talk about in particular, was that psilocybin could be potentially used as another control agent against let's say, Banana fusarium, which fusarium, I forget which species it is now, but there is a species of fusarium in the genus fusarium that is wreaking havoc on the world banana supply. Like I don't know if you all know, but the Cavendish, which is the type of banana that you always find in the stores, the nice one that's all around the world, that one is going extinct. Like it will, within our lifetimes, unless something really dramatic happens, it's going to be gone within our lifetimes. Because of this fungus, because bananas are clones. There's no genetic diversity amongst this variety at all. They're all just made from cuttings. Mm-hmm. And so Fusarium fungus has actually been shown in that one study from earlier about how P. semolencita affects fungi in its habitat. It was found that it was able to inhibit the growth of a variety of Fusarium species. So it'd be interesting to potentially have, let's say, inoculate your field with psilocybin-producing mushrooms where you're growing bananas as a way to deter the fungus because it's found in the soil. Fusarium infects bananas through the soil. So if you had a psilocybin-producing fungus in the soil with your bananas, it could potentially deter the Fusarium. That's never been tested before. But
that was going to be my next question.
No, Summer. That's never been tested, but I would love to see somebody do that.
Yeah, definitely.
So guess what this Fusarium is called that attacks the bananas?
Oh, yeah, please.
It's Fusarium oxysporum, but the I don't know what this means, but there's an F period, SP period, cubensi.
Oh, that's what? That's hilarious.
Yeah, that's super funny.
That's a hilarious
question. What does that mean?
Do you know the F dot, SP dot?
It could be a subspecies, potentially.
Got it. Cool. Formus specialis.
Thanks, Wikipedia.
Cool. Awesome.
Yeah.
There's another like really niche potential for psilocybe as a form of micro-remediation for nerve gas. We talked a little bit about this with Alan Rockefeller in our last podcast. I don't know if you heard about that, but apparently psilocybin needs phosphorus to synthesize it. And if it was in the presence of these neurotoxins, it could potentially harvest that phosphorus from it and turn something evil into something good.
That'd be amazing. I mean, yeah, it does. Like I said before, psilocybin does have that phosphate group, which requires a phosphorus for it to exist. So if it could be repurposed for that, that would be amazing. I don't know if has anybody done that work, or was that just hypothesized?
As far as I know, it was just hypothesized. It's something I read in Mycelium Running, but that it was just a brief paragraph. But yeah, just using them as these miners to kind of break down other toxic molecules is also cool.
Definitely.
And then, of course, there's the help with mental health in the world. And yeah.
Of course. And that's the one that I think that your listeners will probably all be most familiar with if they know anything about it. If they don't, you should find out. Their psychedelics in general are being used for treating a variety of mood disorders. And it seems to be really promising. And even the FDA seems to be on board finally, which is kind of crazy. I'm a bit surprised that they are, but it's been granted. I think psilocybin's been granted breakthrough status or like 2 years in a row now. So
yeah. Yeah, I'm super excited. I think this is going to be huge. And one thing that I was talking about in the China episode and a lot, you know, with just went to the International Medicinal Mushroom Conference in China. And one thing that, you know, we are just so far behind in mushroom research, mycology research, and just the culture, the history around mushrooms in the United States. But what we do have a leg up is with psilocybin research. China, I don't think they're ever going to get there. I don't think they're going to have that support to do that research. So I think that's really cool that we kind of have that niche that we can really dive into. It seems like we're getting government support. We're getting permits by the FDA, you know, to research these things. So I am super excited what the future holds with psilocybin.
Yeah, me too. I think it's I think it's a fascinating field. And I'm really interested to see more, even if my research is more from the ecological side of things. I love reading about the psychological research that is done with it.
Cool. So I'm sure our listeners would love to keep up with you and your research and just follow along of what you're doing and learn more about the crickets that you're doing now and follow you on your PhD journey and just keep up with what is going on with psilocybe. So how can people follow you and how can people get in touch with you?
Sure. The best way to follow me is through Twitter, actually, probably. And you can find me at 0MGEM0. That's my Twitter handle. And also, if you want to keep up with me on ResearchGate, which is a great, fantastic platform for researchers, my name is Matthew Granger Ecky Meyer, or you can find my thesis, which anybody, even if you're not on the platform, if you want to read the full thing, you can go and find that at the link. It's called bit.ly/MMEYER 2017. I believe that will also be in the show notes.
We'll have that in the bio on our website.
And then actually, I also, before we sign off, I actually have a request. Anybody who would like to get involved with the research, I actually have an ongoing citizen science project that I'm running right now, which anybody can get involved with. It's on the platform iNaturalist, which you all talked to Alan Rockefeller about last week. It's an amazing platform for identifying all sorts of species out in the wild. And I have a project called Psilocybin Fungi Animal Damage. And I just, I'm asking for everybody who has access to psilocybin producing mushrooms anywhere in the world, they can take pictures of those mushrooms in their natural habitat and look for any damage on the mushrooms that are potentially associated with insects or other sort of animals, and document that. Because right now there isn't even really any research about why or like what sort of animals in the wild are even actually interacting with these fungi in the first place, which is kind of insane to me, but it doesn't exist. So if your listeners want to get involved, I would really appreciate their help. And you can also find the link in the show notes, but you can also get to it by typing in bit.ly/PSILODAMAGE, like Silo Damage.
Sweet, that's awesome. We're actually looking at it right now, and it seems like slugs love some magic mushrooms.
Yeah.
And I feel like we're going to get some comedians over here of taking a picture of their friend on all fours, taking a bite of a wild psilocybe.
Oh, yes. Let me clarify. I'm looking for animal damage that is non-human animal damage, to clarify.
Here we see some Homo sapiens trying to evolve into Homo cubensis in their natural habitat. So we got one final question that we ask all of our guests on our show. And the question goes, if mushrooms had the microphone and they could talk to the whole human race and could say 1 to 2 sentences, what would they say?
I would believe that fungi would probably say, look down, look at us, and just pay attention. Pay more attention to us, but not only us, the other sort of underdog clades of organisms out there. We contribute more than you know.
Amazing. Yeah. That's awesome. Well, thank you so much. You've been an awesome guest. This has been super, super juicy, and I'm excited to dive more into this myself and just keep this research and this enthusiasm and passion going, because this is awesome. This is really juicy stuff. This is really amazing, and I thank you for sharing with all of our listeners on our show.
And we would love to have a part two when you advance some of your research. So let's keep in touch. Yeah,
absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on. This has been an amazing time. I love chatting about this sort of stuff.
Definitely. Yeah. And thank you everyone for listening in. And this has been an hour and a half of your time of geeking out with us. And this is what we're trying to create with Mushroom Revival. And this podcast is a whole group of people just geeking out about this subject. And we would love to include you into our conversation. So please reach out. You know, we would love to hear what you think, what you want us to cut out or add, any guests that you want us to bring on our show, any topics that you want us to talk about. This is for you. This is for all of our listeners out there who want a community around mushrooms. We're doing this for you, and it feels good. You know, this is a great podcast to bring people around mushroom. And as always, much love, and may the spores be with you.